Report this to the media as soon as we have an indictment.
Sure thing, Aaron.
Talk to you later.
You got it.
She hung up. And then, for the first time in days, she laughed.
The Western Laboratory was not an old building to begin with, but had recently gone through a multi-million-dollar renovation that made it even more modern, from its array of cutting-edge gadgetry to its LEED certification. Amy was soon entering the office of its director, a man with bushy white eyebrows named Chap Burleson. She was holding her evidence bag in her left hand. She thrust her right hand across the desk as Burleson stood up.
Dr. Burleson, I'm Amy Kay with the Augusta County Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, she said.
Augusta County, he said. That's quite a haul.
A little more than an hour, Amy said. Not so bad.
Have a seat, have a seat,
he said in a friendly manner, waving toward the chairs in front of his desk. Amy selected the one on the left.
So what can I do for you, Miss Kay?
You can help me catch a rapist, she replied evenly.
Happy to. That's what we do here.
Great, she said, bringing the evidence bag up and placing it gently on his desk. Then you can put a rush on this for me? The eyebrows rose for a moment before falling.
Well, Miss Kay, that's always the issue, isn't it? Let me explain how things work here at Western. You may not be aware, but we have...
Amy cut him off with a torrent of words. A backlog of 1,200 cases, all of which are very important to someone somewhere in the state. An obligation to treat every case like it's of the greatest concern. A need to be fair to the many jurisdictions that rely on you for forensic services. Yes, sir. I'm very aware of all of this.
Burleson cracked a quick grin before his face settled back to its original state of indifference.
You're stealing my speech, Miss Kay.
I know, and I want to convince you this case is more important. It's term day in Augusta County. I skipped out on babysitting a grand jury so I could drive down here and convince you of it.
Okay, so what's the case?
In brief, broad strokes, Amy told him about the man who had been terrorizing her county for 2 decades and how he had eluded detection for so long. Then she described how she had painstakingly assembled his brutal history, one case at a time, and one long wait for DNA results at a time.
Why haven't I heard about this?
Burleson asked, his eyebrows mashing together into a long white line across his forehead.
Because my boss is afraid of the negative publicity associated with an unsolved case and ordered me to keep it quiet.
I see.
And, to be honest, I haven't bothered you with any of my other requests because I knew it was a cold case, and I couldn't really make the argument that this had to take precedence over the many, many other important investigations you have, Amy said, letting that very reasonable statement hang out there for a second before she brought home her demand.
But things are different now. I actually have a name to go with all these vague descriptions. And I have this soda can with his DNA on it. We have the key to catching this bastard right here.
She shoved the bagged Sprite can a little closer to him.
His pattern has been pretty clear, she said. He attacks every 3 to 5 months. It's been 4 months since his last one. I'm playing with fire right now.
And if you have to wait 5 or 6 months for results, he might attack 2 more women before you can bring him in,
Burleson said. Now you're stealing my speech. But yes, every day that goes by...
I get it,
he said, dragging the Sprite can over to his side of the desk.
I'll see what I can do.
Chapter 21 I drove away from JMU feeling some combination of a blind rage and an all-seeing depression. To state the obvious, Ben had been lying to me. For months now. About nearly everything. I thought of all the seemingly benign conversations we had, about all the deception he had shoveled at me in his attempts to keep me believing he was still a grad student, about how hard he had worked to sustain this elaborate fabrication. It was the level of detail that really shocked me, because when I asked him, "How was your section today?" he didn't just dismiss it with a simple junior varsity lie like, "Good." No, no, he went straight for Olympic-level prevarication. "Kramer gave me a good group this term. They're really making some thoughtful connections between the readings we picked for them and the lectures." And then he'd prattle on for a while about some esoteric aspect of historiography they had mistakenly stumbled upon. Or he'd discuss how woefully unprepared his tutoring students were to do anything resembling real research, how their local high schools had spent 4 years teaching them to take tests, but hadn't prepared them to perform any scholarly interrogation that went beyond a Google search. There were now hundreds of conversations coming back to me, all of them apparently exercises in fiction. Had all of that really been invented for my benefit? To keep me believing I was married to a young academic? If he wanted to drop out, why didn't he just tell me? Did he think I wouldn't understand? Or that I'd try to talk him out of it? And then there was the other question. If Ben hadn't been at JMU, what the hell had he been doing? All I knew for sure was that he left sometime after me each morning, was still gone when I came back after work with Alex, and returned around 8:30 or 9 each night. Was he just out there somewhere, wandering around, dreaming up all the nonsense he was going to spout at me later on? Did he have some bizarre second life he felt he couldn't tell me about? It was just stupefying and infuriating. And what made my head hurt most, and this, let's be clear, was purely selfish, was that this meant my life had been a lie too. Throughout our relationship, but especially in the anguished aftermath of my attack, Ben had been my rock, the one human being I could always rely on. And now my rock turned out to be nothing more than painted dust. When I returned to Stanton, I went straight to our wireless provider's storefront, where they outfitted me with a 2-generations-old knockoff iPhone for free, which still somehow felt like more than I could afford. Once I got out in the parking lot, I sat in my car and wrestled with my next dilemma, which was what I ought to do with this awful newfound knowledge. Did I confront him immediately? Send him a text? Call him and catch him in one last lie? Or did I wait until he came home that evening, so I could do it in person? And then what? Would he have some explanation? Would I even care what it was? Were there some wrongs that couldn't be forgiven? Part of me thought this was too great a breach of trust to possibly allow our relationship to continue. A marriage could perhaps survive an isolated, unpremeditated lie, like, say, a one-time infidelity born of lust or alcohol or stupidity. This deceit felt so much larger than that, because it had been so carefully constructed and sustained over such a long period, with such a high degree of continuing duplicity. How could I ever again trust a single sentence that came out of his mouth? And yet, another part of me thought I had much bigger problems to deal with. I was currently facing felony charges stemming from 2 different causes. I had no job, virtually no money, and very little prospect of improving either situation until I got this cleared up. Without Ben, I would not be able to keep the house. I might not even be able to keep eating. And, paramount above all those things, my baby was currently in the control of the Department of Social Services, which was a lot more likely to return custody to a stable two-parent household than to a single mom in the throes of a divorce. But could I really forgive him, just because it was the expedient thing to do? Did the human heart work that way? There were no answers. And so I sat in the parking lot, staring down at my new phone. It was an implement of immediate marital destruction. But only if I had the fortitude to use it. I didn't make the call. I was too afraid of setting that chain of events into motion. Defeated and overwhelmed, I eventually forced myself to drive out of the parking lot and back toward Desper Hollow Road. When I returned home, I resisted the urge to pull the covers over my head and die, which is what I felt like doing, and instead took the breast pumps inside with me. I'm sure I was imagining it, but I already felt like my milk was faltering. Or at least it wasn't as plentiful as it had been. When I finished pumping, I went through several days' worth of text messages. There were a few from Marcus, which grew increasingly anxious in their level of concern. I fired off a quick reply to him, saying I had lost my phone and that, yes, things were a mess. He was the kind of friend who could handle the truth. The rest? I couldn't even deal. They were from friends I hadn't seen in a while. From my Starbucks days, from college, even from high school, who had obviously seen the media coverage of me and were checking in to see how I was doing. Some expressed wary support. Most were of the timid, "Hey, you okay?" variety. And how was I supposed to answer that? There was also a voicemail message from my lawyer.
"Miss Barrick, this is Bill Honeywell,"
he said in his thick, slow voice.
"I hear you got bailed out after all, and that's real nice. Why don't you call me as soon as you have the chance?"
He slowly left his number, repeated it, then hung up. When I called back, I spent 3 minutes on hold, then heard Mr. Honeywell, breathing a bit heavily, get on the line. He said my social services case was proceeding, and he wanted to walk me through next steps. Now that the emergency removal order had been granted, we moved on to the preliminary removal hearing, most often referred to as the 5-day hearing, because the law required it to occur within 5 business days of when a child was removed from the home. There, we would formally object to the finding of abuse and neglect, essentially pleading not guilty, though they didn't call it that in child protective cases. Then a lawyer for social services would put on witnesses, most likely just the social worker who had been assigned to the case. We weren't allowed to put on witnesses. Not until the adjudicatory hearing, which would happen in another 30 days. But at the very least, I would get to tell the judge my side of the story. Mr. Honeywell left a little air on the line when he said that part, which I took as my opportunity to discuss that side. "So, basically, it's like I said in court the other day. Those drugs the sheriff's office found in my house, they weren't mine," I said. "I swear to you, I have no idea where they came from." He grunted noncommittally.
"Do you have anyone living in your house besides your husband?"
"No, sir."
"Well,"
he said. It came out "whale" again.
Then, as your lawyer, I have to be honest with you. You're going to have a tough time convincing people those drugs weren't yours. Unless you're saying they belonged to your husband?
No, they're not his either.
Is there someone else who has access to your home?
That's not what I'm trying to say. Look, this is going to sound crazy, but I think someone is trying to frame me so they can take away my baby.
I see,
he said. I could hear his skepticism, and it was hard to blame him. I sounded crazy to me, too. I have this video from a security camera, I continued. The day before the sheriff's office raided my house, a man in a fake plumber's van came up my driveway and spent about 15 minutes at my house, then drove away. I didn't call a plumber. I'm pretty sure that's the man who planted the drugs.
Have you been able to identify this mystery man?
No. I heard him sucking air through his teeth.
Well, if you can figure out who this fella is, I can subpoena him. And then he'd have to show up in court and explain what it was he was doing in your driveway. Problem is, if he has a criminal record with drug involvement, the other side can try to argue he was there to buy drugs.
I felt my exasperation growing. So it's hopeless.
Now, it's not hopeless, Miss Barrett. And you won't help yourself much with that attitude. It's just a long process. You may or may not believe what I'm about to tell you, but the judge really wants to give you your child back. You just have to listen to him and show you're willing to do whatever it is he orders. Do you think you can do that?
Yes, of course I can, I said. But what if I'm convicted on those drug charges against me? The prosecutor said something about the sentencing guideline being 5 years. Would they wait until I've gotten out of jail and then deal with me? My lawyer's voice got quieter.
Well, now, no. That doesn't happen. It takes a minimum of a year to terminate parental rights. But most judges don't like to let cases go on much longer than that. They might wait a few months if they knew you were about to get out, but not 5 years. I'm sorry.
He let that hang out there like a massive, gut-spinning, heart-eating lump. My accompanying gasp was, apparently, audible to Mr. Honeywell on the other end.
Let's just take this one step at a time, Miss Barrick,
he said in a lame attempt to now sound upbeat.
The first step is Tuesday. That's when your 5-day hearing has been scheduled. It's on the docket for 10:30. It's important to get off to a good start with the judge. You show up early, you wear a nice dress, you do your hair up real pretty, like you're going to a dinner or something. Can you do that?
Sure.
Good. That's the right attitude to have. Now, I have to run off to court for another matter, but I'll see you on Tuesday, okay?
I assured him he would, then mumbled my thanks. In some ways, I didn't really need him to tell me more about this process. The contours of my future were already becoming clear to me. I couldn't convince a judge I was a worthy mother to Alex if I was incarcerated. The assault case was mostly a nuisance. I couldn't imagine they'd really lock me up for more than a year for scratching an officer. The drug case was another matter. That sentencing guideline was this towering monolith I couldn't go around or tunnel under. I had to go over it, but I didn't even know where to start the climb. I had already seen how ineffectual my protests were. I could squeal out, but those drugs weren't mine, as many times as I wanted. No one, not even my own lawyer, would believe me. I needed to find real proof, not just of my non-guilt, but of my actual innocence. If I didn't, I would lose my son. It really was that simple.
Chapter 22. I was still pondering the impossibility of my task a few hours later when Teddy's rust bucket truck came roaring up the driveway. He leapt out, then beat me to the front door, bursting into the house a little out of breath.
"Hey, this is going to sound weird, but go get a bunch of underwear on," he said. 4, 5, 6 pairs, whatever you can fit."
"What are you talking about?
Remember that friend whose mom works at the courthouse? He just called me. The grand jury met this morning. You got indicted on possession with intent to distribute. That's big time. She just had to issue a warrant for your arrest. The sheriff is going to be coming here to take you in. Probably real soon."
"Okay, but why the underwear?"
"Because Middle River takes your clothes but lets you keep your underwear. If you bring your own, you don't have to use jail underwear. And trust me, jail underwear blows."
I was still just standing there, a little dazed, staring at him. He must have seen that I didn't get it yet, because he gently grabbed my shoulders.
"Sorry, sis. Even if they give you a bond, I can't help you this time. I'm tapped out. You're going to be in there for a while."
"Oh, okay," I said, and at my brother's behest, went into my bedroom and donned as many pairs of bras and underwear as I could make fit over each other. Then I put on some baggy old jeans and a sweatshirt. More room for the underwear. I returned to my living room and kept a wary lookout with Teddy. My new phone was still sitting on the coffee table, where I had left it. I was now even less sure what to text Ben, and I was running out of time to think of something.
"You'll tell Ben I was arrested, right?"
I asked.
"Yeah, sure."
The next sentence sort of just fell from my mouth. "Can you also tell him I went by JMU to look for him today?"
Yeah. Why?"
"Just tell him," I said. I felt like that would be enough to signal to Ben that I knew what was going on, without involving Teddy too much. I didn't know how to explain to my kid brother that my husband had been living a blatant lie for months.
"I can't believe this is my life," I said.
"Me either," he said. After 30 seconds, he said,
"You'll be okay."
He patted my hand.
"Don't do that," I said. "You're going to make me cry."
We waited in silence for a moment. Then I said, "Did you get my email, by the way?"
"Did you send it to my Gmail or my work email?"
"Gmail."
"Oh, I haven't checked that account in a while."
"Would you mind checking it?"
"Yeah, what's up?" he asked.
"I sent you a picture of someone who got caught on one of Bobby Ray's cameras coming up my driveway. It was the day before the drug bust." Teddy understood immediately.
"You think it's the person who planted that cocaine?"
"Yes, but just give it a look. If you know who it is, great. If not, don't go doing anything else with it, okay?"
"Okay."
We lapsed into silence as we stared down the driveway. It didn't take much longer. They sent 3 cars, which struck me as overkill. But I guess, according to that prosecutor, I was a danger to the community. Not wanting to make this any more difficult than this needed to be, I went out on my porch with my hands up. I know the sheriff's office doesn't make a habit of roughing up white girls, but I didn't need them breaking down the door on me. I wanted them to know I was going peacefully. In truth,
I didn't have the energy to resist. They let me keep my underwear, just like Teddy said. Otherwise, it was the same pushing and prodding, the same strip search, the same series of humiliations. The magistrate again denied me a bond. I was a violent offender, after all, meaning I'd have to wait until Monday for a judge to assign a bail amount that I couldn't afford anyway. Knowing I was now in for the long haul, until May 18th or longer, made everything that much more dispiriting. My lone act of optimism was that, every few hours, I went into the bathroom, knelt in front of the toilet, and milked myself. I was determined to keep my supply up. That this qualified as a hopeful gesture perhaps speaks to how desperate my situation had become. After a night of still strange noises and a barely edible breakfast, I was just settling into life in the dormitory, trying to find something to read, when Officer Brown, who I still wasn't able to place, approached me. Without giving any acknowledgement of our past interaction, she told me to line up against a wall with some other inmates. "What's going on?" I asked.
"Saturday morning is visiting hours," she said. "Someone is here to see you."
"Who?" I asked. But she had already moved on to another inmate, leaving me to wonder. We were soon led into a hallway, where we stood in line some more. I was already starting to learn that jail was all about waiting. We all had the time. When it finally became my turn to be allowed into the visitor's room, one of the guards, not Officer Brown, said,
"Melanie Barrick?"
"Yes?"
"You got 30 minutes. Go ahead."
Then he opened the door for me. Sitting at a table against the wall was Ben. He stood when I came through the door. For a moment, that was as far as I got. I was unsure whether to run to him or flee back to the dorm. I could see from his face he had accurately parsed the message I had Teddy relay for me. His shame was that obvious. Even after a night in jail, time I had to myself, with nothing else to do but think, I didn't know what to do with him. I hated that the first clear emotion I was experiencing was this flood of relief at seeing him. Ben, my comfort blanket, was there to rescue me, just as he had so many times before. And yet, at the same time, I also hated that he had lied, hated even more that I had caught him at it. What had possibly made him think he could get away with it? Didn't he know something like that would eventually come out, one way or another? I don't know what it was that made me decide to walk over to him. Maybe it was curiosity. I had so many questions that only he could answer. Maybe I wanted to punish him, to inflict on him some fraction of the hurt he had made me feel. Maybe it was simple loneliness, which would have been the most pathetic possibility of all. Whatever it was, my legs eventually started moving. As I neared him, he approached like he was going to hug me. There was nothing more I wanted, of course. I just didn't want him to know it. He was maybe 5 feet away when I gave him a small, almost imperceptible head shake. He immediately backed off. And damn him if that wasn't one of the things I loved about him. He almost always knew how to read me. I sat at the table. He lowered himself across from me. "There's a lot I need to say," he said softly, earnestly.
"Do you mind if I go first?"
"I guess not."
"The first thing I want to say is, I'm sorry. I've been lying to you, and I feel, I can't tell you how awful I feel about it. This is going to sound like a lot of rationalization, but it really did start as something I was doing because I thought it was best for you. That was a mistake. But then once I made that mistake, I don't know, it became a lot bigger than I ever thought it would. And somehow that made it even harder to tell you the truth.
You're not making any sense right now, I said.
I know, I'm sorry.
Why don't you, just for a real change of pace, start by honestly telling me what's going on and what you've been doing? I asked. I didn't like that I was hiding behind sarcasm, but sometimes you don't get to choose your defense mechanisms.
Okay, that's fair.
He took in a deep breath, then he sighed.
I guess it started when Kramer announced he was leaving last spring.
He said, "For Temple? Yeah, I heard about that."
Just to put it in context, he told me, gosh, end of April? With what you were going through, I don't know, I felt like it would be selfish to even say anything to you about it. I mean, for me, it was this total academic and professional crisis, yeah, but it felt, I guess it felt pretty small compared to...
The end of April was when I learned I was pregnant.
You could have told me, I insisted. You should have told me. I'm not some fragile piece of china. I know, I didn't want to bring everything down when you needed me to lift you up. It was this big, steaming pile of bad news I thought I needed to swallow myself. Kramer was, to state the obvious, he was my guy. You know the politics in that department, and without Kramer around to advocate for me, I already knew we could kiss that tenure-track position goodbye.
So you just quit?
No. Kramer actually wanted me to come with him, but I told him that wasn't possible. I went into the summer, still plugging away on my dissertation, thinking I'd just keep my head down and finish it off. The first domino to fall was when Portman, the department chair, assigned Scott Eaton as my new thesis advisor. He had been on sabbatical and didn't come back until the fall, and then he took his sweet time reading what I had sent him. When I finally did meet with him, it was awful. He wanted me to add some new chapters, blow up most of the ones I had already done. He was pushing this document analysis that, I don't even know if it was possible. Like, the documents might not exist. He was basically talking about starting over. I was looking at another 2 years, minimum, to do it his way. And I couldn't deal. It was so depressing to even think about it. I went to Portman and asked if I could switch advisors, and he flipped out on me, going on about how Kramer had always coddled me, and this was life in the real world, and if I didn't like it, I could just leave. He said it was Eaton or nothing. Ben shook his head. So we're now up to, what, October? I had been in touch with Kramer the whole time, and he suddenly had a slot open for a PhD candidate to start in January. But I had to tell him quickly. Like, in a week. And at that point, you were 7 months pregnant, and we had just closed on the house, and Temple is... it's fine for Kramer, because they gave him a bunch of money. But it's not like it's Penn, you know? I told him what was going on with you, and he gave me this big lecture about how I had a lot of potential, but I needed to see the bigger picture and be willing to make sacrifices for my career. He said if I didn't take this opportunity, he wasn't going to be able to help me anymore, and I don't know. It was pretty bad. It was like every arrow was pointing to the same conclusion, that I wasn't meant to get this doctorate.
Jesus, Ben, I can't believe you didn't tell me any of this. But I also could believe it. This was so typical. Both of my husband, who was more likely to swallow a problem as it grew in size, and of our relationship, which was always about my issues, not his.
I know, he said, but I just felt like so much had happened, and I couldn't dump it on you at that point. We had this baby coming, and the new house, and...
And you thought it was your kid, I said matter-of-factly. Ben had been looking down at the table. When I said that, he jerked up.
No, he insisted. No, that wasn't part of the calculus at all. I was thinking about you, about us. Whether Alex was mine or not, I mean, he is mine. He's my son.
I didn't know if I believed him. What man wouldn't let a child's biological paternity enter his mind, at least a little bit? He continued.
In any event, JMU was just this big dead end. And I thought about starting over somewhere else, but to make you move and find a new job, all while we had a new baby? It just felt too formidable. There aren't a lot of good programs looking to take some other school's dropout anyway. Plus, if not all of my classwork transferred, that would be 3, 4, 5 more years of this? No way. So, in mid-October, I quit. I told Portman I was done, and he said some nasty things, and that was that.
He placed his hands on the table, like the story was over. But, of course, it wasn't. That was when his fabrications morphed from mere lies of omission into something much more.
So what have you been doing with yourself? I asked. I got a job.
Where?
Mattress Marketplace. I work noon to closing.
You've been selling mattresses, I said, in disbelief.
Oh, Ben.
There was nothing wrong with selling mattresses. For someone else. Not for Ben. It was such a waste of his talent.
$7.25 an hour, plus 7% commission on whatever I sell, he said, forcing a smile for half a second before he went back to staring at the table.
So that quote-unquote tutoring job was really mattress sales. Same with the picket fence. That's why you had that extra money.
Yeah, I had some good weeks early on. The guy who hired me insisted he had salesmen making 40-50 grand a year on commissions alone. And maybe at other locations he does. There? Not so much. I think that's another reason I kept not telling you. My whole idea was that once I had saved up a nice little nest egg, I'd tell you, but by then I'd have $10,000 or $20,000 in the bank, and that would sort of cushion the blow.
He made a noise in his throat.
Truth is, I'm selling about one mattress a week. If that. I make 400 in a good week. Sometimes less. I've been looking for another job, but it seems a degree from a liberal arts college in Vermont and 3/4 of a PhD doesn't mean much to people down here. I know we scoff about what you make, but it's damn tough out there to do any better. I mean, I never thought I'd say this. But thank God for diamond trucking.
I didn't bother blunting the news.
I got fired yesterday.
He looked at me for a moment, then brought his eyes back down.
Sorry, he said.
Not your fault.
And I'm sorry I lied.
I'm sorry for letting you down.
I'm sorry I've failed you in just about every way possible.
My anger, my righteous indignation at having been lied to, had already given way to something else. Pity for him. Sadness over what he had lost. Over what we had both lost. Ben's dream had really been my dream, too. How many times, before things got so complicated, had we split a box of wine on empty stomachs and allowed ourselves to get giddy about the thought of life as Mr. and Mrs. Professor Benjamin J. Barrick? And now that was over. Or at least it was for me.
but maybe not for him. Looking at him, I was struck by how damaging it was for him to stay with me any longer. Ben was this beautiful bird, but he would have another feather plucked from him every day we were together. Soon he would lose the ability to take flight. I couldn't let that happen. I grabbed both his hands and lowered my head in an attempt to meet his gaze, which was still cast downward. Ben, why don't you just go to Temple? Call Kramer. Beg and plead. Tell him you made an awful mistake and that you've had a big epiphany and you're ready to make whatever sacrifices you need to make. He'll take you back. He loves you. He'll let you pick up right where you left off with your dissertation and you'll be done in no time. From there, who knows? You'll be right back to having your bright future again. He still wasn't looking at me, so I kept going. It's what you want. It's what I want for you. I'm in a huge mess here, and look, I don't have the time or the energy to be a wife right now. I'm going to be doing everything I can to beat this drug charge and get Alex back, and we've already heard about how little standing you have with social services. There's nothing you can do to help me anyway. Don't stick around and ruin your life trying. You can file for divorce on Monday. I won't contest it. God knows we don't really have any assets to split. Just take whatever you want from the house and get as far away from here as possible, okay? I can't live with myself knowing I'm this anchor on your potential. Just go. Go and write me a letter someday and tell me how well it worked out for you. Maybe when you make tenure somewhere. That's really the best thing you can do for me right now. And then, because I truly meant it, I added, I'll always love you. Goodbye. With that, I stood from the table and started fleeing toward the exit before he could see the tears in my eyes. Mel, wait! But I was already through the door, heading back down the hallway toward the dormitory, going to a place where I couldn't hear him calling for me, where I could be alone with my own torment, and where at least, no matter how bad things got, I wasn't taking anyone else down with me. Well, except for Alex. But maybe it was too late for us anyway. Chapter 23. Amy Kay felt the weight of time all through the weekend. It had been 4 months since Warren Plotz had attacked a woman. By this point, he had to be a bundle of pent-up sexual energy, waiting to explode. Amy could practically hear the fuse sizzling. And knowing she was so, so close to having the evidence she needed to bring him in, and bring him down, made waiting a special kind of torture. The slow drip kind. She actually thought about trying to tail him, to possibly catch him in the act and or thwart another attack before it could happen. Then she dismissed that idea as some combination of foolish and reckless. She was a lawyer, not a police officer. She fought crime from the courtroom, not in the streets. But still, he was out there, surely already stalking his next victim. Could she have him arrested? It was tempting. A long-ago victim sharing a hunch many years later, the fact that Plotz worked with another one of the victims, the way Plotz's personal timeline seemed to match the pattern of the assaults, it would all be great at trial. But Amy had to be honest with herself that it didn't really add up to probable cause. The danger was that if she arrested him and a judge later ruled she didn't have probable cause, she could blow the whole conviction. People bemoaned when criminals got off on a technicality, ignoring the simple truth that the law was nothing but technicalities.
She would just have to be patient. It made for a nervous weekend. Ordinarily, Amy didn't have much contact with the sheriff's office on Saturday or Sunday. Jason Powers called her if something big happened. Otherwise, they had the understanding that things could wait until Monday. This weekend, she called into the dispatcher 4 times, just to ask if any major crimes had occurred. In between, she was so keyed up, she kept taking Butch on long walks, trying to calm herself down. The dog was now exhausted. Her first check-in of the new week came just after she woke up Monday morning. Nothing doing, she was told each time. It was slow going to work that morning. A fog had rolled into the Shenandoah Valley overnight, thick and low, and it was looking like one of those days when it might take a while to clear up, if ever. Normally, Amy loved mornings like this. It was the kind of weather that made life in the valley interesting, unpredictable, and it heightened her appreciation of the mountains whenever it was they came back out of hiding. Now, it just felt ominous. If there was any reprieve from the worry, it was that daytime was safe. Plots preferred the darkness of early morning. With that thought, Amy looked forward to a day of trying to bury herself in the other work she had to do. Instead, when she arrived at her office inside the Commonwealth's attorney's, she was surprised to find a handwritten note waiting for her from Aaron Dansby. Amy, would you please come see me ASAP? It's important. Thanks, AHD. It was unusual for Dansby to be in the office first thing Monday morning. Dansby often commemorated Monday morning on Wednesday afternoon. Wanting to get it over with, she set her things down and went to his nicely appointed corner office, which his wife, Claire, had decorated for him, making it look like something out of Southern Living magazine. Hey, she said, sticking her head through his open door. You were looking for me?
Yeah, come on in.
He had dark smudges under his eyes. He still had that slight resemblance to Matthew McConaughey, except now it was more like Matthew McConaughey coming off a bender. You okay? Amy asked, showing atypical concern for her boss's well-being. You look tired.
Yeah, I'm fine,
he said, waving it away as Amy walked to the front of his desk.
I need to talk with you about Coke Mom.
She has a name, you know. Melanie Barrick.
Whatever.
Amy frowned. Anyway, what about her?
You saw it made the paper on Saturday.
Yes, and?
The party saw it too.
When Aaron talked about the party, he meant the local political party to which he belonged. It was always a little unclear to Amy who, exactly, this party consisted of, whether it was a large group of upstanding citizens, or just a boss and a few sniveling sycophants in a proverbial smoke-filled room. Whatever the case, there was no question the importance of party support. She understood that without it, Dansby would never have won the election in the first place. He was just as dependent on it for his impending re-election effort. Okay, Amy said. And?
And they mentioned it early on at the meeting last night. Then they went on to talk about the slate for November. It was mostly the state house offices, but they did discuss Commonwealth's attorney a little. To be honest, they were sort of vague about it.
Vague about what?
The line, Dansby burst. No one said for sure I'd get it.
Amy suddenly understood why Dansby looked so tired. He had been up all night worrying. Augusta County politics had been a one-party system for generations now. If someone else got the party line, chances were good Dansby would be out of a job. And that wouldn't exactly do much for the career narrative he was trying to build. Wunderkinds didn't lose their first bids for re-election. Sorry,
You're going to have to connect some dots for me here, Amy said. What does the party's endorsement have to do with Melanie Barrick?
Nothing directly, but it's clearly on their radar screen. I had thought that after Mookie Myers, I had showed them I could do this job. But you should have heard them going on about the Coke Mom thing. I mean, a woman and a mother dealing drugs like that, it represents a moral degradation, a breakdown of law and order.
Save it for the jury, Amy thought.
What kind of Commonwealth's attorney allows that to happen on his watch? Dansby continued. When we nailed Mookie, we got him good.
Myers was spending at least the next 10 years as a guest of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and it was unlikely his recent appeal would change that.
And I think it's real important we nail Coke Mom good, too. It'll show the party I'm for real. When's the trial? Can we move up the date?
She doesn't have a date yet. She hasn't even been arraigned.
Let's make sure it happens sooner rather than later. The party usually finalizes the slate by mid-April. I'd like to have Coke Mom convicted by then.
Aaron, today is March... She paused to look at her phone. 12th. I doubt we'll even be able to find a judge with an open date on his calendar for a trial like this by mid-April.
Oh, come on, he said breezily. I thought the Fourth Amendment guarantees her the right to a speedy trial.
That's the Sixth Amendment, Aaron.
Whatever, you get the point.
She's already got a trial set for May 18th for assaulting a police officer. There's no way the drug charges would be scheduled before that.
Assaulting an officer? He said. When did she do that?
There was an incident in social services last week. It got a little out of hand. He peered at her thoughtfully.
How long could we put her away for that?
It's a class 6 felony, but she doesn't have a record, and from what I understand, the cop wasn't really hurt. To be honest, it's overcharged at the moment. I'd never take it to a jury, because they could decide we overplayed our hand. I was going to plead it down and then let her do PTI. Even if we kept it at this level, the judge would probably order her to take an anger management class, then give her 6 months suspended and tell her to behave herself. Something like that. Whatever she did end up getting, she'd probably be allowed to serve it concurrently with whatever she got for the drug charges. Dansby didn't hesitate.
Nolly prosit.
Really? Are you sure?
A nolly prosequi is an entry into the legal record signifying the prosecution does not intend to proceed any further with a charge. It was something Amy did all the time, but usually as part of a deal. She agreed to nolly pros one charge in exchange for a guilty plea on another.
Yeah, I don't want anything slowing up these drug charges. That's all the party is interested in anyway, he said. As a matter of fact, she has the same attorney for both charges, right?
She hasn't had counsel determination for the drug thing yet, but yeah, that's usually how it happens.
Who is it for the assault charge?
Bill Honeywell.
That's the guy with the buggy eyes, right?
Yeah, that's him.
He's basically a hack, right?
He's more of a lawyer than you'll ever be, Amy thought.
I wouldn't underestimate him.
Still, he'll deal, right?
If it's the right deal, I assume.
Okay, then here's what we're going to do. Why don't you offer to nolly pros the assault charges in exchange for going to trial really quickly on the drug thing? Think that would work?
Amy's mouth twisted. I don't know. Maybe. First, we have to find a judge who has an open date.
You'll make it work, Dansby said, bobbing his head emphatically. I mean, just think of how lost you'd be around here without me.
He threw her a winsome smile. Amy did her best not to roll her eyes at him.
You're ridiculous, she said.
He grinned wider. For as lousy a lawyer as he may have been, he was not without skills as a politician.
Thanks for helping me out, he said.
Let me know, okay?
Sure, she said. In truth, for all of Dansby's shortcomings and annoyances, Amy didn't really want a new boss. Right now, she had the perfect job. She got to be Commonwealth's attorney in the ways that mattered to her, trying cases and administering justice the way she saw fit, without having to put up with the political nonsense. Dansby's replacement might be some micromanaging control freak who had very differing ideas about how she should go about things. She'd wind up having to ask permission to go to the bathroom. Better the devil you know. Chapter 24. In what felt like a bad spin cycle on repeat, I was awakened early Monday morning and made to answer the same questions from Blue Ridge Court Services about how likely I was to run away from all my problems. If only it were that easy. By Monday afternoon, I was back on that hard bench, wearing the orange jumpsuit that eliminated any doubt about my criminality, waiting along with other inmates to appear in front of the camera that would beam my image to the judge. When it was finally my turn, the judge looked even more bored than he had been the previous week. In the time it took me to enter the room and get settled into my chair, he yawned twice. He told me I had been charged with possession with intent to distribute a Schedule II drug, then ran me through the same questions about whether I understood the charges and whether I had an attorney. He then told me that since Mr. Honeywell was representing me on my other charges, he was going to represent me in this case as well. Do I have a choice? I wanted to ask. Instead, I just said, Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Honeywell shambled into the bottom of the screen, wearing what appeared to be the same rumpled gray suit he had worn last time, or a reasonable facsimile thereof.
Your Honor, if I may, I'd like to consult with my client for a moment or two before we begin our bond hearing.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Miss Barrick, he said, turning toward me. We've heard something of an unusual offer from Miss Kay, the prosecutor, and I'd like to discuss it with you before I accept it on your behalf.
Okay, I said, sitting up a little.
The Commonwealth has agreed to drop your assault charges, but in exchange, they've asked to go to trial on the drug issue much sooner than I otherwise might be comfortable with.
How soon?
We've checked with Judge Robbins's chambers in Circuit Court, and he has an opening for a one-day trial on April 9th.
I didn't need to consult lunar charts to know April 9th was before May 18th. The possibility of getting Alex more than a month sooner overwhelmed any other rational thought I might have had. I was now practically leaping out of my chair. I'll do it, I said quickly.
Now, hang on a moment,
my ever-slow-talking lawyer said.
I want us to think this through. I know it's nice not having to worry about those assault charges, but the drug charges are much more serious. We'd be looking at 4 weeks to prepare your defense. That's not much time. My granddaddy always said it's better to do things right than to do them right away.
He was a man with all the time in the world. April or May or June made no difference to him. He couldn't understand there was a clock ticking inside of me and that each second was another explosion. I would never get these months of Alex's life back. They were so precious. I had read the baby books. They all stressed how critical every phase of development was, especially during that first year. Every month mattered. Every day mattered. And maybe it was stupid of me to rush to trial, but unlike Mr. Honeywell, and the prosecutor, and the judge, and everyone else, I still believed in my own innocence, which is what motivated my next utterances. "It'll be fine," I said. I'll take the deal.
Mr. Honeywell looked at me for an extra long beat.
Okay. April 9th it is, he said.